Welcome to another episode of the Drunk Guys Book Club, where books aren't just for school, book clubs aren't just for women, and beer makes everything better.
I'm Nate.
I'm Mike. We're the Drunk Guys.
This week, we are reading The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead.
Super famous book. This came out this year, or last year, on Oprah's book list. Won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. Long listed for the Man Booker Award. Probably some other awards along the way.
The National Book Award.
Yes. Did it win it?
It did, yeah.
I'm sure number one bestseller at some point. And it is a heavy, heavy book. That I'm gonna need a beer immediately to start with.
Even just to talk about
just
it.
Just to start. We'll start with this. So the book is called The Underground Railroad. The Underground Railroad in American history is the history of the abolitionist movement during the times of slavery that would help, or the abolitionists would help slaves escape from slavery to the North, all the way up to Canada in some cases, or most cases probably. So the first beer we have is Other Side IPA, because that's what they're trying to get, the other side. This is from fairly local Greenport Harbor Brewing Company, which is in Long Island. I'm like Greenport, Long Island, which I actually visited their brewery last summer, and it was a really cool place.
Cool.
So there you go, sir.
Thank you.
This was no easy book to find beers for, I must say, without being offensive or insensitive,
mm-hmm.
or just really way out there that wouldn't, the connection, even by our low standards, would be too far. But at Trader Joe's, they had this. I was like, score.
Excellent.
Very nice IPA. I mean, there's nothing almost like IPA fatigued in life. It's hard for an IPA to stand out.
We've been drinking some rather unique IPAs. Check last week's episode.
Yeah, last week's. We had previous ones. We've done a mango IPA. We've done Belgian-style IPA. We've done
double IPA.
Yeah, we've done a bunch.
Dark IPA.
Mm. A couple of black IPAs. We got some more IPAs in the future. If we do certain types of books, I got some IPAs ready in the cellar. This is great. This is a mm-hmm. nice beer. I hate to use the word session IPA. That's like the hip term for sort of a low alcohol IPA muted version. This doesn't tell you an alcohol content on the bottle that I see, but I can't imagine this is particularly strong. Probably 5 or 6%. So it's not quite session territory. That's like 4, 4.5. That's a nice light IPA that you could drink on a warm day and not get totally shit-faced off right away.
Right away.
Though I wouldn't mind getting shit-faced off. That's good. So what's the book about?
This book's called The Underground Railroad, and it is about the Underground Railroad. Or specifically, the main character is Cora. She's a slave. Actually, the very beginning talks about her grandmother and mother. Cora's a slave in a plantation in Georgia, and the first part of the book, the first chapter of the book really talks about what it's like to be a slave on a plantation. We'll talk more about that later. And then most of the book is her escaping from slavery. Whereas she actually gets on, she escapes her plantation, and she gets on an underground railroad and manages to find her way to some rather odd locations, some of which are freedom, some of which are not. That's the premise of the book.
Yes, and Nate did not misspeak. She doesn't get via the Underground Railroad, the figurative Underground Railroad you learned about in school, but on a literal Underground Railroad.
Railroad tracks through a tunnel on a train that takes slaves to freedom.
Which you might be thinking is called the subway, but it's not. We had to do, actually, probably the most research we've ever done for a podcast
mm-hmm.
to see, like, maybe we just mislearned shit in school. Maybe we're just dopey. But no, there's some interesting stuff there. So the book, that is really the plot of the book, though it is more twists and turns in that.
Yes.
Some of the other characters are, of course, other slaves and escaped slaves or attempted escaped slaves. Also, some freedmen.
Mm-hmm.
And the villain of the book is this slave catcher, Ridgway, who's this big, muscular, mean fucker who just revels in his work and is the best.
He's the best at it.
He's the dog, the bounty hunter of slaves without the stupid hair, but with success. So Ridgway is the villain. So actually, I should rewind. Cora's mother, Mabel, had escaped from the plantation where they lived. So the book starts that Cora is approached by another slave about escaping. I liked the writing in this beginning part, especially when she said no, because that was her grandmother talking. And they talk about mm-hmm. the grandmother then. And the grandmother says, the grandmother's life is of course awful. The grandmother is the one that is abducted by other tribes in Africa and then sold several times over until she reaches a slave ship and is taken over the Middle Passage and all that. And she then is on several plantations throughout her life and dies as a slave and has a horrific ordeal. And the grandmother's attitude is one of sort of just like, I'm just going to find the best I can in this situation and try to ride it out. She sort of accepts it. And then later on, Cora is asked again, and this time she says, yes, I'll go. And I said, this is her mother talking. And it turns out because Cora's mother, Mabel, had escaped. She had escaped from the plantation where Cora lives and was never caught. Even the great Ridgway, the great catcher, failed in catching her, and it is a point of shame for him, a personal shame for him that he failed to catch her. So when Cora escapes, he sees this as his opportunity to sort of perhaps redeem himself, or at least not, he sees like a chance or some sort of sick justice that he can capture too.
Mm-hmm.
So he's our bad guy, and he is 100% unlikable and awful. Not only awful to the slaves, awful to freed black people who he just treats like shit, but there's a part where they talk about how he helped murder abolitionists.
Yeah.
And you know, he is truly awful, and you know, unfortunately, characters like this existed in history.
The very first section of the book is talking about what it was like on the plantation, and then she runs away, or she, her and Caesar, one of the other slaves, they run away. This guy who helps them out puts them on the Underground Railroad, and they encounter several very strange situations. So, okay, the very beginning of the book is very realistic. The author, Colson Whitehead, did a lot of research, and he used slave narratives. So the very first part of the book, what it's like to be a slave on a plantation, is very realistic. The rest of the book isn't. And it isn't supposed to be. You know, there was no actual underground railroad tracks that brought slaves to freedom. So that's the first part. Second thing is, whenever they arrive somewhere, they didn't arrive at a real place, although the first place is South Carolina, and that is North Carolina. That's what he says. But they're not actually meant to represent real places. They're meant to represent ways the country has tried to deal with slavery, has tried to deal with Africans or African Americans by themselves. And so they're not meant to be real, but they are based on, they're based on history, just not in the same particular time.
Yeah, and it's weird. And I did not know that at the start of the book. I especially because the first part is so shockingly raw and realistic. I get to the point where she's on the railroad. I'm like, man, I must have actually been some trains I didn't learn about. Oh, South Carolina had a really weird program I never learned about in school. This is strange. Mm-hmm. North Carolina had a fucking even weird, more awful thing happening. How did we not learn about this? And then kind of realize this might be more allegorical than it is meant to actually represent something that happens.
Yeah, it took me a little while to decide, you know, this is definitely not meant to be strictly historically accurate. It's meant to be more than that. But at first, it made me feel a little bit weird about the book.
I mean, besides my own self-doubt, thinking I didn't know things that I thought I had some understanding of, then I thought, maybe this guy doesn't know what he's fucking talking about.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, this is on purpose. There's a reason for this. These things mean something. Which was strange. It's weird. Like, why go from one to the other in a book? Usually if a book is a magic realism kind of book or something like that, that's like that from page one. But this book sort of shifts. Starts with these rather realistic, though the most extreme, horrible slave narratives.
Hopefully the most extreme.
Well, there are brutal passages where, you know, slaves look at the owner the wrong way and they're blinded. Or slaves talk back a little bit and then they get beaten to death. Or they're just slow, or they're not too, they haven't been educated, and they say something and then they get tortured for it. Or the runaway slave who is excruciatingly executed publicly while the white slave owner and their company have a tea party and watch this multi-day ordeal as this man is tortured to death.
And not that some of those things or all those things didn't happen in real life, because I'm sure there's at least a chance that they all did, but they all happen on the same plantation at the same time or within like a year or two of each other. That's the part where it's more extreme than real life. Hopefully.
And unfortunately, there's probably no way to quantify that. And some people will probably say that actually it was worse than that every day. Some people say it was significantly less. It's hard to say.
And all of this is before page 10.
Yeah,
the book.
It's deep in there. I have to believe that it's exaggerated just because slaves represented a commodity. Yeah, there were people, but at the same time, to the slave owners, to the slave traders, to the slave overseers, these were property, and they had economic value. And
sometimes
just
a lot.
Yeah, and to just kill a slave, now that I have to say didn't happen, because there were, of course, lynchings and awful things during slavery as well as after, to just kill slaves all the time was actually bad business. And slavery was, at the end of the day, a business attitude. It was economically, actually, it's probably a really shitty one. Better. People are more efficient. Labor is more efficient when they're actually paid for it.
Well, we could get into the history of economic history of slavery, but we won't just for this podcast. You know, the slave owner in the book is portrayed as not just a businessman. He wasn't, or maybe he got into growing cotton and buying all these slaves, but he was just a sadistic individual. I can't say that after this much beer. Anyway, he was just a sadistic individual who took pleasure in causing all of this pain and suffering and death to his slaves.
It's about power.
So it was about his own power as well, not just about the economics.
But then there are also the people beneath him who have power too, right? I forget the Irish guy's name, the overseer, who's old and fat now, but he takes a different slave woman every so often to rape, and he is violent and whips them and, you know, does these horrible things. So there's, I think at least that the violence here is a little exaggerated just to believe, not that it never happened, period, but that it happens in such a concentrated amount of time and place that might be a bit of license taken there, I think. I mean, it ultimately actually doesn't really matter for the book, because, and the point of the book, I don't know yet, but it doesn't really matter. It just, it's so jarring that you start to think about, is this even realistic? And I think maybe it was exaggerated for to achieve an effect.
Certainly.
So some of the weird, what's also some of the weird shit that they find?
So once Cora manages to escape on the Underground Railroad, her first destination is South Carolina. But it's not just anywhere in South Carolina, although maybe the whole state is supposed to be represented this way. I'm not sure. But anyway, so South Carolina, her and Caesar are given their freedom, and they're set up in sort of a former slave, not barracks, what's the word, dormitory, and they're given some schooling, they are basically found jobs. You know, most first as Cora was just a maid, but they're actually paid for their labor and they have their freedom. And they're living in this town, which is set up specifically to do this.
Well, they have like freedom with an asterisk because they're technically all owned by the state.
Right. So I'm sure that is definitely there intentionally, even though they're told, oh, it's just a minor paperwork issue. But technically, your falsified paperwork says that you're owned by the state. That's how you got here, if anyone asks.
Which is interesting. Now, this is something that, to my knowledge, never existed anywhere. Right, this is just totally made up stuff meant to represent other things, but we'll talk about it. But there could be a reason why the state has to keep ownership of them, because if they are not owned by somebody, or their previous owner still lays claim to them, then they could be, you know, extricated or whatever back to where they
were. Or kidnapped back into slavery.
Or, yeah, as some freed people were, like, was it 12 years a slave? That book, I don't think that guy even was it. Was he a slave in his childhood? I don't even remember. But he just gets kidnapped in the North, sold as a slave, and people are like, oh, you're black guy, so you must be a slave. That's how that's going to work.
So Cora, she's in this town, and everything seems actually pretty good. You know, she has a place to live, and she has her own job, and she has her own money, and, you know, things are going pretty well. And she ends up going to the doctor kind of a lot, like many different times. Not that doctors knew anything back then. Well, and several other strange things happen. And then after she's there for, I don't know, something like a year?
It's been a long time.
Many months, if not a year, they find out that the doctors are basically they're running experiments on the slaves, on the former slaves, and that there's part of the program is to get slaves to volunteer to be sterilized, just so they won't, you know, so they won't have any more kids. Just that's the idea. And one of the doctors tries to convince Cora to help convince some of the other slaves, you know, get yourself sterilized. Cora and Caesar realize that this is very, very strange, and so they eventually decide to leave. So anyway, that actual event, that didn't happen in South Carolina at any time during slavery. At least not that I know of, but no, I don't think so.
I can't imagine.
It was meant to represent, though, a real historical event, which were called the Tuskegee Experiments.
But those were probably a century after when the book takes place.
Yeah,
I mean,
this
those
is
were the 1940s or something.
30s, 40s. 30s. Well, that actually, those set of experiments went on for decades.
Right, what were the experiments in the Tuskegee?
So what happened way back in Tuskegee, wherever, Tuskegee, Alabama? So a group of sharecroppers, like a whole sort of community of sharecroppers, doctors were seeing them and testing them for syphilis. But what the doctors weren't doing is they weren't telling them, oh, you have syphilis. You need to do something about this. They were testing them for syphilis, and then they would come back, and it was pretty much a longitudinal study about the effects of syphilis. But they did it without the sharecroppers' consent. And without even informing them that they have this disease. And it went on for decades. It wasn't just for a year or two. It was decade after decade. They had syphilis and they were giving it to other people and they were getting worse and worse. No, it wasn't found out till decades later what was happening.
Yeah, and it is an atrocious event. But if you want to write about the Tuskegee experiments, why don't you just write a book about the Tuskegee experiments? Why change that so much to fit it into the slavery story, which is already rife with horror? Why do you need to double add more to it? That's what I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't know either.
It's an interesting choice, and perhaps we're totally wrong in our analysis of that scene, but I don't think so. I mean, I got that vibe for us. It seemed kind of eerily familiar, but it just struck me as weird and anachronistic, to say the least.
So where Cora goes next on the Underground Railroad, she ends up in North Carolina, where North Carolina, in the book, has decided to deal with their slavery problem in an entirely different way. They decide to just completely eliminate anyone of color.
Well, first they outlaw slavery.
They do outlaw slavery. It sounds like a good thing, right?
Right. Great. How progressive. And then they're also going to, like any black people, freed, slave, or other, are going to be killed.
Yeah. Just murdered.
By the government. Not just like lynch mobs, but just Now, what does that represent? Like, because that's not a thing the government did anywhere either. I mean, there was things individuals did. Those were things that terrorist groups like the Ku Klux Klan did, where they wanted to terrorize and exterminate blacks and or get them to leave or whatever, or both. But the government never did that, to my knowledge.
No.
Nothing like that. I mean, the government has been inactive, but was never proactive in that.
In the book, it's not said that it's the federal government doing this. It's just the local community. It doesn't even seem like it's the whole state. At least I didn't get that impression. It was just the local community that decided to do this. So what does this kind of represent in real life? Well, it probably represented some of the kind of white supremacist communities or even white separatist communities that existed somewhere in the West, I think in Oregon, after the Civil War. Or maybe even a little bit before, but definitely after the Civil War, because, well, after the Civil War, the United States had this problem, which is, now what do we do with all these freed slaves? A problem as in, you know, most of the white community would rather just forget that that had ever happened. They just want to forget and make the problem go away. How will those people govern themselves? Which was the whole argument against freeing the slaves in the first place. And so some communities, they just wanted to break away and just have it pure white.
Especially in the later 19th century, people co-opt Darwin's discoveries, say, well, they're incapable of self-government. They're incapable of society because look at how they live. Of course, conveniently forgetting that, you know, these are people who had a century or two or three of slavery in their family, that, you know, to expect them to be producing works of literature and writing about Plato the moment slavery ended is a little ridiculous. That's fucked up.
That's much later in the 1800s when that idea became a bit more popular.
But the idea, before the Civil War, even like the great emancipator made, there are comments that people made where they just think that, you know, the Negro is of inferior intelligence and they are not capable of the same thing as the whites are. Like, there's quotes of Lincoln saying this.
There are.
So they might not have had the same, they might not have used the social Darwinism explanation that would become very popular later with the sort of resurgence of the KKK in the, or not, not that they're related, they just happened around the same time. That was the thinking, and it very, I think it's embedded a little bit in Underground Railroad too, right? There's, going back to the South Carolina thing, I forget the woman's name who was the teacher, who was teaching Cora how to speak proper English, and they give them the exercise books to practice learning how to read and write, but sort of, they were like, oh, you're making excellent progress. Like, I don't know, maybe I'm imagining this, but there's kind of like the sort of, always, every one of those compliments has a little asterisk with it, of for a slave. Before an African or whatever. I don't know. Maybe I'm just projecting that because that's a common thing people think about today too.
So anyway, she's in North Carolina and in this community that is completely outlawed just not being white. And so she has to hide in an attic. So one family takes her in and she has to hide in the attic. But there when she's in the attic has a little window where she can see out on the square, on the town, little town square. And definitely bad things happen.
Right.
So,
what, a lynching?
So first there's a minstrel show, although they don't even call it that. They call it something worse. And there's a minstrel show, and then there's a lynching. And then eventually when she's found out, when the family's maid turns Cora in, oh yeah, that family, they have someone in the attic. She turns them in just to get ahead in the world, as she says. Cora almost ends up getting lynched there too, but manages to escape.
Right, so the Cora story features incredible luck for her at every turn.
Mm-hmm.
And she's the main character of the story, so it's like the suspension of disbelief for her that she gets away from every terror.
So Ridgway comes and captures her when she's there.
Right. So she escapes the lynching because isn't he take her back to
he's gonna take her back to Georgia.
He of course decides first, I have other business and I'm going to first stop by, he has to like travel with another slave somewhere else.
In Tennessee.
And that gives the opportunity for Cora to escape. But, you know, kind of dramatic scene, because Ridgway is they describe it actually a couple times. Colesmile describes what Ridgway looks like. And he's specifically 6.5 feet tall. They say that several times. He's like the build of a blacksmith. And he's got like thick bull neck. Like, he's a big fucking dude. 6'6" dude now is big, but 150 years ago, probably even a little bigger.
He's half Thor Bjornsson
of
the 1840s.
He's a monster. So, and he's ruthless, and he beats the shit out of people. Ridgway's this fucking motherfucker who, he relishes beating slaves, raping them, punching abolitionists, killing them. He's a horrendous human being. He takes her back to where he's sort of in tow to do his other business. There's this dramatic scene where, despite how big and imposing he is, Cora's just will to escape. Cora's badassery kicks in, and she shoves him down a flight of stairs, I think is what it is.
Well, that's not until the very end.
Wait, how does she escape? Oh, no, that's
so
right. She escapes the other time first. Yeah.
Slaves attack Ridgeway. And freeing all the people. So Ridgeway manages to escape because he's going to come back later in the book. But anyway.
He's the T-1000 of slave catchers.
Cora. Oh, no. Anyway, so she gets to a new place where rather strange things happen to her. But before we talk about that.
Because it seems like what's happening there.
We need to talk about a new beer. There we go. So, this new beer is called Liberty Ale, which, you know, I think it's self-explanatory why that fits.
I think she chose a good time to talk about it because it seems like that's what she receives or achieves. This is by Anchor Brewing Company, one of the earliest craft beer companies, I believe, and an excellent company at that. This is 5.9% alcohol. There's a whole long story here about making their beer, but it doesn't really tell you a whole lot about what it tastes like. They're just saying, like, distinctive bouquet. I mean, so I don't know what you'd call this. I'm sure it's like American Pale Ale or something like that is what you would call it, classified-wise. This is not an IPA. It's not that hot.
No.
But it's nice. It's got a nice sort of sweetness to it. That's great. I like Anchor Brewing a lot. They make some really good stuff. Right, what is their... They make a really good barley wine, I think.
So here's what happens next. Cora makes it to Indiana, and these are where the freed slaves are from, makes it to a farm in Indiana owned by free black men who are trying to live out on their own farm and sort of make it for themselves. You know, they're so, whereas the community in North Carolina was trying to eliminate all people of color, on this farm, they're trying to, all the freed slaves are trying to live together. Like, we can run this whole farm by ourselves.
Well, pretty impressive and the right kind of idea, right? Like, that's what you gotta do. And, and what a lot of freed slave communities ended up doing, both during the time of slavery itself, but especially afterwards.
Yeah.
A sort of communal reliance to help people help them for themselves.
My understanding, it was more west than Indiana, although Indiana was still considered kind of west at the time, so maybe that's still accurate. So they're kind of out west slaves just deciding, you know, we're going to make our own communities, and we're going to be just by ourselves. But the problem is that because some of them are runaways, or really just because they're all still African, that they're running the risk of getting kidnapped back into slavery at any time.
Which, spoiler.
Which not only did that happen in real life, but that is also what happens to Cora. So Cora is, not finally, Cora, she's kidnapped, Ridgeway makes a return, recaptures Cora, she shows him a new part of the Underground Railroad. This is, remember, an actual Underground Railroad.
He makes her show him.
So that he can find it and destroy it or do something like that. But she kicks him down the stairs. After a fight, she kicks him down the stairs. He's severely injured. And then she emerges. She ends up outside and finds a caravan traveling west. And she ends up going out west.
And that's how it ends.
That's the end of the book.
So I wouldn't call that a happy ending.
I mean, it has the potential that she's going to emerge into freedom for the rest of her life, but it doesn't tell you specifically that's what happens.
Well, because at any other point in the story, or at several other points in the story, it could have paused or stopped. And you're like, oh, that seems like she escaped that. Oh, she got off, she took the Underground Railroad first she escapes the Randall Plantation. They run for a few days. They almost get caught. In fact, in the beginning, it's three slaves have escaped. Her, Caesar, and Lovey. Lovey gets caught almost immediately, about a day and a half later. Never hear from her again, but based on what happened to the other escaped slaves, she did not have much of a life after that. But she might have kept alive, but just severely punished. Then they escape from that, and you're like, oh, they've escaped. That could have been a short story, I suppose. Then she goes to the railroad itself, goes to South Carolina. That seems like they've escaped something, but then they find there's something darker and awful there. They escape from that. Well, that could seem optimistic too, but then they find something worse, differently bad, escape. That kind of pattern happens and happens and happens. There's no reason, unfortunately, to believe that this final pass is the one that makes it okay. Like going out west. Oh, it's all cool out west. It's all safe. Just wasn't,
well,
especially not in this world.
It doesn't say that it's definitely all safe. It's just leaving the reader with the perception that maybe it could be okay out west.
No, it reminds me of the end of The Handmaid's Tale. How, you know, like, well, probably it looks like she's escaped for now. You don't really know much more after that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is annoying to me as a reader. I like conclusive shit.
Closure.
Because it's a story. Like, you're making it up. As much as it might be historically based, give me a fucking ending. I mean, I know that literary critics and people are going to say, well, that's simplistic and whatever, but I'm not reading this book to write a paper for my, you know, the metaphysics of antebellum slavery in fiction, like, graduate level course.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading it because it's a best-selling book. It's supposed to be really good. A
Yes.
Essentially reading to be entertained. I like an ending. I don't know. Maybe I'm just, you know, in, what's the word, uncultured or inelegant to my preferences. I just find that frustrating. Though I guess it also is effective because maybe the point is at the end, I'm like, well, they never really, the slaves didn't really achieve freedom for quite some time. And some would still argue that they haven't entirely at all.
You know, if this book is an allegory to the present day, perhaps Colson Whitehead is saying, well, there's potential for in the future to go through the tunnel and find freedom and peace and all these kinds of things, but maybe not yet. Maybe I'm interpreting too much, but maybe that's what he's saying.
I mean, certainly there are people who argue that. Did you like the book?
You know, personally, I didn't love the book. I was really excited to read it. I thought, especially in the beginning, because the first chapter is just about life on a plantation. I mean, it was really, really dark, but it was really sort of brutally honest and sort of just drops in these like devastating, just devastating things, just almost as a throwaway line until you realize, oh, that is like really, really devastating. But then it just felt weird once you get past her first escape from the plantation, because it was an actual railroad and actually underground. Like that turned me off a little bit. And like I said, it took me a while to realize that wasn't supposed to be literal. He wasn't saying that really happened. And then the other weird places she ends up, it's like, that didn't really happen, did it?
Yeah.
I just didn't love it. I didn't. And it's not the part that it was dark. The fact that it's so dark that turned me off, although it is definitely very dark. I don't know. The weird history part is what made it feel weird to me.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I actually enjoyed the reading of the book. I read it really quickly, basically in one day, and really was engaged. I really wanted to know what happened next. I liked the way it was written. I liked the use of language. I liked the way it kind of ended with, I don't want to say a cliffhanger things, but in a way that you're like, oh, well, that just ended crazy. It just happened there. I need to know what happens now. But it was strange because there's so much, like when he talked about the book on NPR, you were saying earlier, he read lots of slave narratives, right? He did a lot of research. So you expect some historical veracity. And then just make stuff up to achieve some other goal. I don't understand that. I'd rather have been one or the other, personally. Yeah. Rather be all this sort of like historical magic realism, magic historicism, mm-hmm. or all just historical fiction that's very real history. Doing that both, I think kind of it makes the message harder to see because you're not sure, oh, is this a thing that really happened or is this some sort of thing I'm supposed to interpret now? Because then you go back and look at those early sections. After you read about the weird statewide slave repurchase program in South Carolina, or you read about the actual railroad with actual stations,
mm-hmm.
you go back and look at the first section and read about the torture of the slaves. And you're like, well, maybe, is that not right? Is that something? Is this supposed to mean something else too? Well, no. I think that's actually supposed to be what it is, right? It's brutal. It's like over the top in its awfulness. Because that shit happened, it just makes you think about the whole thing differently. I thought that was weird. Thought it was weird to combine the two. But you know what? The book has been wildly successful, so what the fuck do we know? We're just drunk guys. So what are some real things about, like, so comparing the book to whatever history, because we're history nerds in addition to book and beer nerds and just general nerds.
I'm not an expert on the actual Underground Railroad, but I did read an article, this one by Henry Louis Gates Jr., of Beer Summit fame.
That's right, Beer Summit.
Yeah, so that's an Easter egg for you podcast listeners. Here's what the article said, and it's not comprehensive exactly, but he said largely what Americans have come to believe is the Underground Railroad, specifically, you know, lots of, hidden attic spaces and hidden basement compartments where runaway slaves would be hidden by the kindly white people before they're spirited off to the North or to Canada. That is mostly a myth. Now, maybe not entirely, but it is mostly a myth. And he went further to say that it was a myth created decades after the end of the Civil War to make, and even the early 20th century, to make the white community feel a little bit better about itself, or give it more of a role in eliminating slavery before slavery was eliminated by the Civil War.
Than just having 600,000 of them die.
Exactly. According to the article,
they did do something, just kind of in a fucking
They did
way.
Do something, but this part they didn't do. Well, according to this article, for the most part, when slaves were trying to escape, they had to make it past the Mason-Dixon line by themselves. There really weren't networks of kindly white people to hide them. They really had to basically find their way to the north by themselves. And once they got to the north, they could get more help. And that's more where the myth might be slightly more realistic, where they would get help being hidden away and being sent, you know, further along north until eventually they could get to Canada. Apparently, most of the people who operated the real Underground Railroad in the north were mostly freed slaves or free men, free women, or Quakers, or perhaps both. So that part is real, that the Quakers were important in that. But overall, the numbers of slaves who really did escape is tiny compared to the number of slaves there were. You know, the estimated somewhere between low end of maybe 25,000 slaves over the course of many decades, up to maybe 100,000. And that's like a very, very high estimate. But if you look at the number of slaves total, it's just a tiny percent.
The number of slaves total is a million. I mean, the number of imported slaves to the New World is, what, 10 million? Though the majority of them went to South America. But then you have the generations born into slavery. It makes counting it really difficult.
Counting is difficult, but, you know, we're talking tens of millions.
Now, they do kind of, I mean, maybe I'm imagining this, but one of the things that bothers Ridgway, the villain in the book, is that the Underground Railroad has opened up a station in Georgia. And they've never been this far south. He kind of talks about that at one point, that this is not where he doesn't expect to see them there, and that's why he takes such intense focus and pleasure in trying to stamp it out on his turf. Which, unfortunately, because what the hell section of the Constitution said that that slaves needed to be returned to their original owners, if they were found in slavery, that was only removed after the Civil War.
That wasn't just the Fugitive Slave Law?
The Fugitive Slave Act of 1853 or something like that, signed by a guy who also opened up trade with Japan. Number 13.
Millard Fillmore,
thank you.
Fugitive Slave Act of 1850.
Slave Act of 1850. But there's a thing in the Constitution. It was removed because, you know, 13, 14, 15. The Fugitive Slave Clause. Article 4, Section 2, Clause 3 required, quote, a person held to service or labor who flees from another state be returned to the owner in the state from which that person escaped. So the 13th Amendment removed that. So, not to defend what Ridgway does in the book, but one of the things that really makes slavery a fucked up, thorny issue to discuss is that there's the ethical issue, but there's also the legal issue of it. And that makes it really interesting to discuss with people depending on their frame of mind and their... It is an interesting topic to write a book about in 2016, 2015, right at the end of the tenure of our first black president. As we see things like Black Lives Matter and stuff with movements in our country, like clearly the issue of slavery directly is solved, but other race issues are not packaged up yet. Maybe that's why the book has been so popular, is it's timely in a sense. I mean, we don't need to reread Uncle Tom's Cabin to get another story about slavery. It's something new and fresh. I don't know if there's anything about the modern world embedded into this book. I didn't really catch anything, but maybe. So, the Underground Railroad in reality might have been just as... The Underground Railroad we learned about at school might be just as fictional as the Underground Railroad in this book.
Yeah.
Because there was no physical thing. Do you know, as a kid, growing up in New York, there was like a local news store. They found this house near where I lived that was right on the... near the Hudson, or whatever... inlet of the Hudson that is, where the Hudson that is, or whatever. But actually, the entire Hudson is next to it. A basement of a house they found a tunnel. The family was doing renovations or something. They found some sort of tunnel in the basement. Local news people kind of weren't. They thought, oh, this is an Underground Railroad thing. People must have smuggled people out through here during slave times, because people certainly lived in that area, though that house was built decades and decades later, it turned out. It was actually just used for smuggling booze during Prohibition.
Which is cool, also.
It is, but less noble. Yes. You don't pat yourself on the back quite as much. Like, you know, my house was used for helping slaves, versus my house was used for smuggling bathtub gin.
my house was used for helping drunk people get drunker.
Gangsters
like
totally
house.
Profited off my house. I descend from a long line of bootleggers. Just doesn't have the sort of cachet or whatever that you'd get from this slave thing. So maybe that didn't really happen much at all. Though I do recall ever learning about that in school, it was always that it was the Quakers or the white people who did this because they were just against slavery in general, whereas many other Christian groups used the Bible to justify slavery in weird ways or to condone it, which, well, there is slavery in the Bible, in the Old Testament especially, but both books. Well, I think that'll do it for this, because I am about as bummed out as I can handle for one day. So why don't you join us next week when we're going to review or read and discuss
The Snowman by Joe Nesbo.
Yep. So in the meantime, you could tweet us at DrunkGuysBC or
send us an email, drunkguysbookclub@gmail.com.
Until then, see you next time.
Thanks for listening.